Hello and welcome to Unfrozen episode 105, The House of Dr. Kuhlhaas. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik, and we are delighted to have with us today the editors of the first and what hopefully will be many gumshoe architectural mystery series, The House of Dr. Kuhlhaas being the first installation. We have Thomas Weaver and Françoise Fromenot. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thanks for having us. Hello.
So we are absolutely fascinated with this. Why the idea of what is the gumshoe series? What is mysterious about architecture to you two, and why was Dr. Kuhlhaas the first subject?
Well, I suppose that any human production has a part of mystery. And architecture, most of all, is very complex to grasp in all its implications and reasons. And the idea is that there are so many buildings of architectural history that one thinks have been totally elucidated. And the interpretations are being sort of rehashed by teaching, by books, by architectural histories. And the idea was to question that, to re-examine them as if they were cold cases in a way, and decide that there were probably much more to them than already existed in print or in discourse, and to try to sort of elaborate around this idea and start with some buildings which are obviously mysterious. And I think the Villa d'Alava is one of those.
It's also the series, or the platform as a whole, is in a way an implied critique about scholarly and academic writing, which I think we both felt over the last decades, 10 years, last 10 years especially, have become a kind of inner language, you know, internal only to itself, read by academics, for academics. And that sort of rather wonderful moment in the 60s and 70s of a rather more a general intellectual audience from people outside of the academy infused into it was something that we wanted to return to by creating a deliberately, willfully trashy or populist platform, like a detective series or a detective novel, and kind of teasing that within the academy.
And the recourse to that particular literary genre, which is the detective novel, which is a modern genre, which has to do with the city, which has to do with not with the police, but with the idea of chasing some odd corners of human activity in complex settings, and sometimes a little odd or dark, was perfect, especially because it is quintessentially a popular genre of literature. So the books, and at least the first one, the one I wrote, is trying to pick up on that genre and its inventions. The fact that the detective, who is the writer, tries to follow sometimes false leads to create a sort of suspense, coup de théâtre, and to use the investigation perhaps to sort of digress, and go much beyond further to map a territory which goes under the pretext of the building which is examined, much further than its strict scope.
Well, very interesting. It seems like the House of Dr. Kuhlhaas is in some ways a kind of like a Cliff's Notes for SMLXL, which is Kuhlhaas's seminal work with Bruce Mao. What was it about that book that you felt needed explaining? And what about the Villa d'Alava particularly inspired this writing?
Well, it's not so much the book that I wanted to explain. I wanted to use what Kuhlhaas shows of the Villa d'Alava in SMLXL as the subject of an investigation on the villa itself. Because I think visiting it, as I did, triggers some intuitions, and mine was that it was a surrealist object when I went there. I tell a little bit the story in the prologue. I was there invited by the owners on a Bastille Day evening, because every 14th of July they organize a kind of little garden party where you go on the terrace and you watch the fireworks on the Eiffel Tower, over the Eiffel Tower, from the terrace. And so it's at night, you have this sort of gathering, you have this sort of charme discret de la bourgeoisie, sort of idea of Louise Buñuel, you know, and one thing sort of leading to the other. I thought, oh, but this house is a surrealist object. And then from then on, with this intuition, it was, how would you prove that? And I found this idea of, which I explain in the sort of so-called method, that perhaps Kohlhaas has written and published a lot, and on the other hand, he's built a lot. He's always claimed that the two do not really communicate. He has these two offices, OMA, AMO, the mirror sort of offices. And my claim was that by not so much looking at the villa itself, but looking at how he talks about it, that there are some embedded explanations that I had to spot, formulate, theorize, and confront with the villa itself. That's what I did, and it takes the shape of a sort of detective investigation, because it was full of course, you cannot be sure. It's full of conjectures, of interpretations, of, again, false leads, but true leads. And it's this sort of mental process that I've tried to organize as this little essay, which, of course, rests on a lot of iconography, which is as much of a proof as the text or the argument itself. Hence the form of the book, which is lavishly illustrated with black and white images of all sorts of references that sort of delineate like a kind of cultural self-portrait of Kohlhaas, fantasized by me from his two productions, which are the villa itself and the way he talks about it in SML Excel. I don't know if I'm being clear.
Of course, there's so many ways to take this. I would love to, both of you, to go back to your earlier reference here about a sort of a critique of architectural criticism itself. I would love to know why it sort of falls short in being able to analyze and interpret both Kohlhaas and the Via and SML Excel. But then also just, I'm curious what your references were in creating this. It reminds me of Paul Auster's City of Glass as a self-referential detective novel. It reminds me of John Berger's Ways of Seeing in terms of the lavish illustrations in black and white. It reminds me of Bruno Latour's Aramis, among other things. So many places to jump off. But I guess as a way to wrap those questions up is, how do you feel about using the detective novel? Was it a better toolkit for this? Should we be writing more detective novels about architecture? It feels like we are, if this is the first in the series. But how did you feel that that genre allowed you to reveal things about Kohlhaas and this project in a way that traditional criticism or academic writing would not?
Well, I think in terms of Kohlhaas, which refers back to Daniel's earlier point, is there is also an additional kind of irreverence or kind of contrarianism in the way Francoise and the series itself focuses on a building, that you understand the most contemporary of architects, the most mediated of architects, through something as recherché as a physical object, otherwise known as a building. Something that in a way Kohlhaas has teased and played with himself, distancing himself from the responsibility always to produce buildings. But this series returns architectural discourse to thinking about ideas and images and associations through the prompt and the pretext of a building. That's sort of fundamental to the series. But I think it's also, it then becomes a kind of mise en abîme or sort of layered in and of itself, because Kohlhaas himself is endlessly playing off that physical object. It's very much his first building. So it's a kind of calling card to all of his ambitions. So all of the ways that Kohlhaas layered and overlayered his ambitions for his own career and his own office onto that building as something, a part of the things that Francoise unpicks. And that then lends itself to the kind of detective strategy. And in terms of that detective, it's very easy to be sort of slightly evangelical about the detective novel and see everything as a form of detection. or even to be actually paradoxically rather academic about it, and to sort of point out all the different kind of scholars who have either had a kind of guilty fondness for detective fiction or an open affection for detective fiction, you know, all the way back to sort of Weimar writers and as well as detective writers themselves. But to us, at least, it seems such a kind of not just adaptable and elastic kind of methodological model for thinking about any kind of idea, but just a kind of such a joyful one. You know, it's such a pleasure to write and to edit and to read it in that form.
Well, Françoise, who was your reader in mind that you had for this? I mean, again, thinking of John Berger's Ways of Seeing, it's sort of the book of art criticism that everyone reads. It's so approachable. Did you mean it in this way as well? Like, should this be someone's first book of architectural criticism, given its appealing form factor and the way you've written it?
Oh, my ideal reader would be, I don't know, an architect or a student in architecture, or anyone interested at broadly in visual culture, buying it in a train station, in a bookshop, hopping on the train, reading it during his or her voyage, and leaving it on the train while stepping down for someone else to read it. That's the idea of the circulation of ideas, which I think are so, how can I say, which I'm trying to demonstrate that in the Villa de Lava, all that ideas, references circulate, are put at work. I would like the book to do the same. You see, like, again, a mise en abîme. But to go back to your question, I think it's really quite nice that if every reader can recognize his or her own idea of the detective novel or references in the book. I think if it's that open to interpretation, this is great. This, if it's supposed to be a imagination opener as well, and not something totally conclusive or closing the debate, like so much academic work is trying to do very often. It's the reverse. And my reference for all this is perhaps the detective novel of detective novels, which is The Purloined Letter by Edgar Poe, which is, of course, coined the genre, and where what is from which what is generally remembered is that what is the more you show something, the best it is hidden, and is these paradoxes which I like to put at work in this book, in the collection, I think, and it's an idea of perhaps creating a lot of potential interpretation rather than closing down the story.
Well, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention giraffes. So there is a, as you mentioned at this top of the call, or the audio listeners, of course, won't be able to see this, but there is a pair of giraffes sitting on your mantelpiece. And the giraffes do play a pretty significant role in the interpretation of this building, which stands on spindly legs. And I think it was kind of very characteristic of Kuhlhaas that he would have staged an appearance of giraffes almost in satire of his own building, which was his sort of debut, first real built work that was in itself kind of a critique. What does the presence of the giraffes mean to you? And is this a sort of take on absurdism or surrealism? And what do you think he was trying to say with those, with the appearance of the giraffes, but also some of the other staged happenings that occurred, which ultimately became photographs in the SML XL book?
Well, I don't want to spoil the plot for those who haven't read the book yet. But what was impressive in all that giraffe story is that the giraffe, I mean, these photographs, which have been taken by Hans Wellermann, during a kind of a week, I think, photo session where there was a plot, imagining the villa in a few decades, what would happen to it. There were some animals that had been brought in. I mean, it was a whole show from which Kuhlhaas takes the the steel shots that he uses in SML Excel. So there was already a little plot around that. Where did these images come from? And they were supposed to be also alternatives to the sort of traditional photos of architectures that you find in journals. And there was this giraffe, which was on all these shots and which were published at the time in architectural magazines. And everybody said, ha ha, there is a giraffe. But nobody seemed to think it was odd or that there was something behind that. It was exactly like Edgar Poe. It was so blatant that it was hidden by commentary. So, and of course, the presence of this giraffe acquires a particularly salient sort of significance when you start to unravel the mythology around this animal, how it was perceived, why it is a sort of hybrid animal, why it was so looked at as a symbol of mannerism or exoticism when it arrived in Europe, how it was represented by all sorts of painters, the history, almost the icon. Iconology of the giraffe is extremely interesting to explore and sheds an oblique light on its significance in SML Excel. And of course, it is a very strong surrealistic symbol. So it sort of rejoined my hypothesis that the house was a surrealist object. But I don't want to spoil it too much. You force me to very, very contorted explanations to not do so.
Well, I have one question about your method there in that regard, too. Unlike, I know the second edition of the book, which I'm sure we'll talk about, the next in the series, which is a project whose architect is, in that case, deceased, Kuhlhaas is alive. I was curious if you sought to interview him, delved into the OMA archives as much, sort of dealing with him as a subject in addition to just to criticism as well, too, because, of course, his story overall, his total story, which, of course, you deal with, his past works, is not yet done. So I'm curious how you see Kuhlhaas and whether, how you sought to engage with him as a subject.
Well, you know, before this book was published, I wrote a few versions of the same plot. One of them, thanks to Tom, who sort of offered to me pages in A files, of which he was an editor in chief at the time. And that was 10 years ago. And I'm sure Rem has read that piece. And every time I've met him, which has happened a few times, I told him, I think we should meet and talk about surrealism and blah, blah, blah. Yes, yes, yes. And it never happened. So I do not know. I do not know what I think he will probably acknowledge the fact that in any work of architectural history, and I think somehow the book is part of that, there is a part of fiction, and he's used that a lot to himself in with Manhattan in Delirious New York, etc., etc. So, but I haven't had any reaction from him. But Madeleine Vriesendorp wrote to me that she absolutely loved the book. And Terry Damisch, her friend, who did this film, you remember, around Delirious New York. And, I think it's exciting to people who know the story to take it as a sort of playful exercise. But as for him, I don't know. I don't know if he will react, and he's perfectly entitled not to.
Well, I am curious how you see Rem and his relationship to modernism at this point. I believe you refer to his controlled delirium in the book itself, referring perhaps to Delirious New York. But how does he stand as a figure in your eyes over the arc of his career? I was at the opening of Countryside, the Future at the Guggenheim in February of 2020 on the eve of the pandemic. And I don't know, talking to other actual architecture critics there, friends of ours, Ian Vollner and Eva Hagberg, who attended, we sort of agree that in our youth, his approach, his almost nihilistic approach to things seemed refreshing versus the sort of cant of the day, but that his approach had sort of worn out. And I'm curious how you see overall his importance as a figure against the totality of his work, his writing and more.
I'm not sure I'm very interested in that, honestly, in figures, I mean, of course, it's important in our super mediatized world and personified and all that. But honestly, I'm much more interested in what people do than what they are, really. And I'm interested in Kohlhaas's work, what he's brought to architectural discourse, what he's written, how he's been an eye-opener. And I use this expression on purpose, considering the importance of the question of eyes in the book. What I find extraordinary is that it's an architect who started his career with a book, and that this book sort of has continued to work within his work all this time long. That is something I guess that's something which perhaps makes a figure in this consistency in spite of swerving around this trajectory, starting with a theory at a time when there's very few theories emitted. It's all that makes me interested in Kohlhaas as an intellectual, a writer, a designer, all that together. And perhaps it's what makes him such an interesting and relevant figure, if that's what you mean. But as to try to second guess if he's cynical, nihilistic, whatever, I'm not sure. In France, he's had so many problems with that, you know, with this sort of political critique, which was used to completely overshadow the actual difficult questions that his work and his writings were constantly addressing to people who were too sure of themselves. So I don't want to enter too much into these sort of disqualifying kind of assessments.
Wonderfully put.
Yes, I mean, this is certainly the other big mention that hasn't yet been made, but of course has been alluded to, is in the discussion of surrealism, is Salvador Dalí, whose influence appears either explicitly or implicitly, in some cases drawn out by your own insights as a writer, and in some cases called out explicitly by Kohlhaas in his own description. What did the dialogue between Dalí and Kohlhaas in the house itself represent for you in your distillation of the meaning of the Villa d'Alva?
Well, Kohlhaas says it himself. He's less interested in the iconography and the ideological diktats of surrealisms than in Dalí's method, the paranoia critical method, which he states as the method that helped him to write Delirious New York. So perhaps some extrapolations I make in the book, in terms of iconography, in terms of digressions on other figures of surrealism, is probably also mine. I mean, that's what I'm not trying to sort of outwit Rem and say that's what he meant. I'm asking the questions. And I am an actor of these questions. And I've always been very interested in surrealism, precisely because of these sort of capacity of and claim to endless interpretations of realities and the creation of alternative realities and alternative interpretations. And I don't know how to explain that, but... Dalí is probably the most radical and the most dérangeant, disturbing figure of that movement. I find he's a very good sort of guide through this maze of architecture, art, theory, psychoanalysis. I mean, this mix of domains and disciplines that are intertwined in the house, in Rem's culture, and in mind, in a way.
And the other figure that we haven't yet mentioned from the era, but definitely cut from a different cloth, is Le Corbusier, whose own villa is not far away, and many of his clients' villas also in the region. I think if perhaps there was ever a stereotype of the most serious type of architect, it is probably Corbusier, and in some ways, Kuhlhaas's take on things is almost like a direct reaction to that, which isn't just to say that he's unserious, just that he's actively questioning with the way that he presents his own critiques. What have you got there, Greg?
Sorry, listeners, you can't see it, but I'm literally holding open spreads where, you know, comparing and contrasting the two villas against the Corbusier.
Indeed.
As well. They're held literally in juxtaposition. So,
but I think what's so interesting in talking about these surrealist artists and the way that they're used to comment on architecture and its then if not current contemporary meaning when the house was constructed in the 80s is that, you know, a lot of those guys, Buñuel and Dalí, you know, came up during Corbusier's time. Do you feel like they were oppositional to the kind of order that he wanted to impose, and that you know, Kuhlhaas is somehow in league with Corbusier's contemporary peers in the art world, or was there more in common between those contemporaries chronologically than meets the eye, so to speak? not to put too fine a point on it.
Well, I think Le Corbusier is more than a giraffe. He's more than a piece of evidence that is followed by the detective. He's, you know, the Villa Savoie is another body in the morgue alongside the body of the Villa de Lava, and in a sense, the narrative reviews both of these sort of these bodies, these states. So they're very much in dialogue with one another. But again, I think I don't want to spoil the denouement for you, but. Françoise's text is very much a negotiation between the Villa de Lava and Le Corbusier's more heroic villas.
Indeed, and the level of detail, for what is relatively, again, a train ride's, as you say, a train ride's worth of a book to consume, relatively concise book. You pack a lot in there, pretty much every conceivable you know, reference and interpretation is applied and kind of thrown out as a question, as you say. But it ends up, yeah, holding together. It has a rhythm and cadence that is quite, well, is quite detective novel-like. So I guess the question then would be, how do we move on to the next in the series? And it is alluded that this will be... the Marxist headquarters by Oscar Niemeyer in Paris. Are there others in the pipeline, and what is their sort of relationship to this debut book in the Gumshoe series?
Well, the ambition, Daniel, is that there will be two titles every year, always appearing within the same Gumshoe series. So in some sense, all the texts are self-similar, in that they're explicitly adopting a kind of detective narrative and presenting a building as a mystery that they're in some sense solving. The design of the books is also a template, which gives us there'll be a certain self-similarity to each title. But of course, everyone writes differently. Everyone interprets a kind of detective brief in a different way. And so the nature of the text won't be the same. In terms of forthcoming titles, yeah, the next one is on Oscar Niemeyer's Communist Party headquarters building, also in Paris, written by a professor of poetry, Lytle Shaw from NYU. But then other titles we've got lined up. We've got a study on the Parthenon, might as well go back to the kind of mothership. We've got a study of a case study house by Craig Elwood, Poltzig's IG Farben building in Frankfurt will be a subject of another one. So we've got about six or seven in the pipeline. In a way, this is the difficulty of editorship. We're slightly over-commissioning them, and then when two of them are ready, we'll land those planes. But yeah, the ambition is definitely at least two per year.
I was waiting to find out when one would be running the investigation through Raymond Chandler's territory of Los Angeles.
Well, that's, you're going to have to wait for Craig Elwood's case study house. And that one, as you anticipate, really indulges in all of that LA noir that in some sense, in terms of its prose, is going to be the most detective-like, or at least sort of James Ellroy-like, if not Chandler.
I was going to ask if the authors would adopt different elements, aspects of detective, hard-boiled, you know, noir, etc. So I'm glad to hear that there will be some, yeah, Ellroy-esque writing in it.
Because the idea is not only that there is a mystery and there is an investigation. I think the way it's written has to depart from, again, the academic kind of style, if there ever there was one, even if there are footnotes, which are understood like, you know, how do you call that? Evidence, you know, in plastic bags, iconography, and each writer has his or her own kind of take on the writing. But it has to, it is as important as the iconography, as the story itself, as the building, and all that is supposed to coalesce in this kind of new genre of architectural writing, which is an old genre of literary writing.
Well, I really must congratulate you both on creating something that is accessible, but then sparks so much further curiosity. I hope that this gets wide play and does become the sort of thing of, you know, airport and train station bookstores where the general public will be picking it up out of sheer curiosity, even if they've never heard of these architects or these buildings before. Thank you so much for spending time with us today on Unfrozen.
Thank you.
Thank you.